Okay, welcome everyone to this research colloquy on private health insurance. I do especially want to welcome participants who are not members of the ACTRIS Institute, and also just to let you know we've got about 40 participants who are joining us on the webinar in Melbourne. We hope that those in Melbourne can hear us and also encourage them to become involved by writing in with your opinion so that we can read it out. And Elaine Grace, the Deputy Chief Executive of the ACTRIS Institute, has kindly volunteered to basically sort of take those questions and feed them into the discussion here. My name's Anthony Lowe. I'm Chief Executive Officer at Prostate Cancer Foundation Australia and also Adjunct Associate Professor at Menzies Health Institute, Queensland, and I'm chairing today. And I must admit that when I agreed to chair the meeting, when Elaine sort of put a hand on my shoulder and I agreed to chair it, I had to look up the word colloquy. According to Wikipedia, it means one of two things: a discussion or conversation, or a meeting to settle differences of doctrine or dogma. And I guess over the next couple of hours, we're going to find out which of those two we've been involved in. So there's no doubt that private health insurance has become a hot topic in the national discourse. In his address to Labor's National Health Policy Summit last Friday, Bill Shorten said that three health-related issues inevitably come up at his community forums. I'm sure people will have seen that Bill's been doing a number of community forums. And he said that the three issues are ICE addiction, suicide prevention, and private health insurance. And according to Mr. Shorten, the narrative that he hears at his community forums kind of almost always runs something like this. So the speakers paid their taxes, including the Medicare levy. They've struggled hard to keep up with private health insurance. The premiums keep going up faster than the rate of inflation. And for a lot of people, there's a genuine affordability issue there. And then they get sick. And what they can't understand is why they face such huge medical bills when they've paid their taxes and they've paid their private health insurance premiums and struggled to do so. And I think that that narrative neatly encapsulates four broad themes that we want to cover today. So first of all, what is the role of private health insurance in the Australian health system? What services should it cover? And what can be done about high out-of-pocket expenses? My interest is as Chief Executive of a consumer-based cancer organisation, and cancer patients in particular face very significant out-of-pocket expenses when they get cancer. So that's the next topic, I guess, broad theme that we want to cover. So why is health insurance so expensive? Why are premiums rising them faster than CPI? We've got a number of representatives, both of consulting firms who advise health insurers and the health insurance industry and health insurers themselves today. So I'm absolutely confident that there are many people in the room who can explain exactly why that's occurring. Next issue, what's the appropriate rating system? So the current lifetime community rating system, is it sustainable and is it equitable? And another issue that we particularly want to talk about is how does it incentivize or not healthy behavior? Because a number of insurers are obviously interested in the idea of Fitbits and exercise programs and responsible drinking and those kind of things, but actually doesn't change your insurance premium. So how does it incentivize, how does the current system incentivize healthy behavior on the part of all of Australians? And finally, what can be done to improve community understanding of private health insurance, including exclusions and so-called junk policies? Again, I'm sure a number of people in the audience will say, well, you see, Bill Shorten's speaker just doesn't really understand how the private health insurance industry works and what it covers and what it doesn't. And I'm sure that's right. But I think what we're hearing in the national discourse is that most Australians don't really understand what private health insurance does and doesn't cover. And it comes back to Susan Lee's question when she was health minister, which is what is the value proposition for private health insurance? Now, one prominent actuary that we hoped would be here today, but unfortunately can't join us, is the former director of the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, Professor Richard Madden, but he raised a number of issues with Elaine, and I hope, Elaine, you'll bring some of those up later. But one in particular was the funding structure for private health insurance, or rather the lack of it, and therefore a proper reserving base. He made the point to us that about 20 years ago, I think, he and John Walsh had been involved in doing some work for the Actuaries Institute and had pointed out that if you didn't have a proper reserving base of private health insurance, premiums would rise at about 0.5% above CPI. And Richard said, so frustrating, because that's exactly what's happened. So those are the broad policy themes, but we want to cover obviously everything that people want to cover. So the format today is, I'd like to allocate about 20 minutes for a discussion on each of those themes, and leave about 10 minutes at the end for wrap-up and summary, and that should get us out of here on time at 2 p.m. I would say our aim is to start a collaborative discussion on the key contemporary issues concerning private health insurance. I do want to emphasise this is the start of the discussion, and I will hand over to Elaine at the end to talk about what next from an Actuaries Institute point of view. What we aim to do is, as actuaries, we want to bring our evidence-based and factual approach and particular expertise in health insurance and health insurance pricing to the debate and inform and influence it for the good of the whole Australian community. So before we get going, I just want to remind us all of the basic context. I think it's important that we sort of think about private health insurance in the context of the Australian health system overall. And for those of you who are interested in numbers, which is probably most in the audience, I would point out that whilst the ad for this used the figures from Australia's Health 2016, which are based on 2013-14, I'm just about to talk about the ones that are in the financial report that AIHW issued, which are actually 14-15 figures, so they're slightly different, but that is part of the issue in discussions of this sort. So Australia's health system, of course, is multifaceted. We've got a mixture of public and private providers. In 2014-15, health expenditure was estimated by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare at $162 billion, which according to them is about 10% of gross domestic product, which is a bit bigger than the OECD calculated numbers, but never mind. Or looked another way, approximately $6,800 per head of the population in Australia. So one way or another, we're kind of each paying $6,800 for our healthcare coverage, men, women, and children. I think most would know that our spending is slightly higher than OECD average, not much. And way below our friends in the US, who is something like just over 17% of GDP. So they have a huge health spend. And approximately 68% of health expenditure is actually made by government, both federal and state government. 18% is made by individuals by way of out-of-pocket expenses, 8% by private health insurance, and 6% by other means, particularly accident compensation schemes. So just to put that in context, it always staggers me. 18% for out-of-pockets and only 8% for private health insurance. Hence, I guess, part of the misunderstanding of Bill Shorten's consumer about how the system actually works. So I'd like to start with the role of PHI, what PHI should cover. I'd like to ask that people who speak sort of introduce themselves and the organisation that they're from. You'll see that there are these rather high-tech microphones in front of people. If you are near the microphone, then it should pick you up without needing to sort of get up and stand near it. But if you were a bit positioned away from a microphone, you might want to come up to the mic and actually speak. So we're talking about the role of PHI, what it should cover, should coverage be broadened, those sorts of issues. If you wish to make a contribution, please raise your hand and off we go. So If nobody's going to talk, Rob, why don't you talk about the role of PHI, what should it cover, what should it not cover?
Anthony, is it okay if we discuss something that comes before that?
Okay.
And you asked the question, I think it's a very good question. Is the current private health insurance system sustainable?
Okay, yeah.
Now, I'm probably one of the few people in this room who thinks it is not, and I have said so for a while. But the evidence for what I say is that private health in gross private hospital insurance premiums, tabular premiums, have increased by about 8 to 9% per annum at the gross level on average over recent years. Net premiums, net of rebate, have gone up by significantly more than that on average and by a massive amount more than that for some individuals. In FY12 and FY13, there was a much higher increase in net premiums, but that increase in net premiums is continuing because the rebate is indexed at only CPI, and of course premiums are going up by much more than that. Per person, real incomes in Australia have been declining since 2012. And although we've seen recent evidence that they're increasing, and have resumed their normal 1.5% above CPI, we're yet to sort of get back to that as an established position. So I would like other people, is there anyone in this room who thinks that the private hospital system, as we currently have it now, is sustainable? I would like to hear them say why it is.
Okay, thanks. So you broke the rules, Rob. That's probably because I called you out. Yes, so Rob Payton from Rob Payton Consulting. I think there are two things you've raised, Rob, which are interesting to talk about. The sustainability, of course, but maybe somebody from a private health insurer or consulting firm can talk about exactly what the drivers for premium increase, you know, we've just had Greg Hunt agree to an increase. What are the drivers for premiums rising higher than CPI?
And
come on, Jim.
Will you let me go on? Because yeah. In 2 minutes I can do that. Essentially, gross hospital claims have increased by about 8% per annum. And that has arisen from claim amounts increasing by around 4 to 5% per annum. And that was the industry's fault because the industry has overpaid Ramsay and Healthscope over this period. And you just need to look at Ramsay and Healthscope's annual reports and you can see that in evidence. Utilisation has increased by around 3 to 4% per annum. And that's where the focus of reform needs to be, because the penny is finally dropped that claim amounts that private health insurers cannot continue to generously fund Ramsay and Healthscope and the other providers. So utilisation increases by about 3 to 4%, has increased by about 3 to 4% per annum. Partly that is due to ageing, partly that is due to increased utilisation from better health services being available, and partly it is as a result of the degrading of the stability of the private health insurance pool as a result of the changes to the rebate, means testing, etc. So they're the reasons.
Could you also say
have increased.
Part of it is...
Sorry, can you introduce? Sorry, introduce yourself.
Warwick Gard from Ernst & Young. You didn't mention sort of like for like. You mentioned ageing, but what about deterioration in health, like for like age?
So each year of age that the PHI population increases is worth about 5% generally in hospital claims. Is that what you mean?
No.
I think Warwick was talking about us getting unhealthier.
I think that's a given. I think everyone understands that.
Yep.
As you get older, you use more health services on average.
Hospital services.
But if you also then look at the utilisation for a 35-year-old today versus a utilisation for 35-year-old 10 years ago, a 60-year-old today versus a 60-year-old 10 years ago.
Okay.
Don't you also see increases in utilisation.
Yeah, so that's my 1 to 1.5% per annum from health services just being better.
Well, is it health services being better or is it people being unhealthy?
Okay, perhaps it's that.
Well, there's a third, sorry, this is Justin Todd from Quantium Health, a third hypothesis, which is a change in behaviour of the medical professionals as well.
Mm-hmm.
So people cite technology. Sometimes technology comes in at a more expensive price. So, for instance, robotic surgery for prostate cancer, it doesn't necessarily deliver better outcomes. Right? And so this is an example where, I guess, technology has gotten better, but it doesn't necessarily lead to better health. But it does increase costs and utilisation.
Good point.
So private health insurers are payers. They're not interveners. They will never be interveners in Australia. And, you know, that's a matter for doctors. We pay and we see the costs, you know, coming through from hospital. That's the answer to your question.
Maybe if I take a contrary point, back to the question, which is, what should we cover? At the moment, I think private health insurers cover, you know, hospital admissions, medical services associated with that, plus some ancillary parts. But if you ask the question, should insurers also be covering, say, primary care, if you start thinking about prevention, should they be contracting directly with medical providers and the clinicians as well and influencing the behaviours? I think that's a fundamental question that goes back to the question asked. And we can say, you know, it's out of our hands and we should never have managed care, and I think the AMA would be very happy with that. But I'd probably open up to the room and say, if we want to make this sustainable, do we need to change the status quo? And do we need to influence upstream and influence the demand and then address the utilisation? Or do we wait for the government to do that for us?
Well, we're here to ask the big questions and, you know, think broadly. So
Stuart Roger from Deloitte. I pick up this sustainability with elements of, is the private system sustainable, elements of the premium stuff as well. And your original question, and to me, the sustainability question first needs to be asked about the entirety of Australia's health system. And when you can look at what's happening in the private sector, and it's a microcosm of what's happening across the board, and coupled with some cost shifting as we encourage things to happen in the private sector. When you look at the public sector, we don't actually have a well thought out statement of what is the minimum set of health services that every Australian should be entitled to. And a number of people have seen me talk about how health increasingly has become a consumer item, right? So I wear glasses, you've seen me do this example. I wear glasses, I could have an operation or I could have contact lenses. I wear glasses because I feel comfortable that way. It's a consumer choice. It means that I now trip more often, run risks there, but I don't use the surgeon, the optical surgeon. So my consumer choices are influencing flows of money in the whole hospital system. And it's difficult to answer what's the role of private hospitals and private health insurance without dealing with what is the minimum Australian entitlement to health services, and then out of that minimum entitlement, who should be paying extra because it helps the system to survive. And I'd frame it that way rather than just honing in on the private sector itself. If you hone in on the private sector, you have to have the assumption that the public sector will remain stable. Not such a good assumption.
Ben Nui from DBN Actuaries. I think Stuart raised the point where it's unclear what is the, you know, what is the purpose of health insurance. So at the moment we have health insurance covering, you know, catastrophic claims where claims can be very large but very low probability, but we also have a lot of claims where it's a very, you know, frequent, very high probability and very small, you know, sums of money for benefits. And that is, you know, a bit of a balance between true insurance and a buffet. Currently we have a buffet system where you can go in many times and claim for things you know you're going to, you know, benefit straight away, and then you can leave the system as well. So it's just not clear what exactly are we trying to achieve here. There's no real, you know, purpose or a mission statement on health insurance. Is it a funding mechanism? Is it insurance? Is it a bit of both? And that's where I think that's, you know, where consumers are getting tripped up, because they think it's insurance, but it's not really. If they're expecting to claim a pair of glasses every year, get your dental checkups every year, and if you don't get that, it's bad value.
So we've got some representatives of health insurers in the audience. It would be good for to get some views. You know, Rob has well and truly thrown down the gauntlet from the get-go. Is the system sustainable? It would be good to hear from some health insurers, their views on that. Well, whether you believe it is sustainable or not, be interesting to hear.
Okay, I can have a go at that. I work for Defence Health, which is a health insurer. So I think it's an interesting question because, I mean, as you mentioned before, the premium has been increased as much higher than wage increase and CPI increase in general. And well, we started seeing the affordability of health insurance impacting participation in the industry. So if this continues, I mean, whatever method the government, whatever government initiatives put in place, we're going to see falling participation. So as an industry, we need to have much better understanding of where the levers that we've got to control cost, whether it is benefit or even managing expenses, and to understand much better understanding of consumer perception of health insurance in general. I really agree with Ben around the type of insurance we're dealing with. I mean, most people buy car insurance because they want to protect the car and they don't want to crash the car. In health insurance, it's slightly different. Because of that mix of covering for catastrophic events like heart surgeries and things like that, versus buying glasses and having a preventative scaling clean every year, people get very confused the notion of health insurance. And because of community rating, unlike other types of insurance, we're not allowed to risk rate people. And as a result, we introduce products which excluding the scope of the product rather than charging the right price. And that actually introduced even more confusion to the consumers. Most consumers do not understand CMBS schedule. Most consumers do not understand the difference between head and neck surgery versus joint surgery. When people want to go and claim something and they find out they're not being covered, because to be frank, most people do not want to understand this stuff until they need it. Mm. And when they find that moment, when they have the moment of truth and find out that they're not being covered for something, even though they've been told every year, if not every half year, about their entitlements, I think they're perfectly entitled to be frustrated with the system. That lack of affordability and that lack of perceived value for money of the health insurance product is definitely driving down the sustainability of the system.
Okay.
And I think, Roman Hardy from Teachers Health Fund. I also think that the medical professionals we deal with don't understand health insurance well enough either. I was dealing with a specialist with my family who didn't know what health insurers were and weren't allowed to charge for. They're like, why can't you just pay the full fee? And I'm like, we're not allowed. And they were like, obviously had a patter that they went on to their patients about how, you know, health insurers were ripping them off, not understanding that we actually weren't allowed to pay for some of the things he was proposing. But he was also saying, you know, if he had surgeries he could do more cost effectively and at less risk to the patient in his surgery, but weren't allowed to pay for them. Whereas if he admits the patient, he can. So he said a lot of patients choose to be admitted just so they can claim on their private health insurance. You know, it's a crazy system.
Did he then mention the size of his out-of-pockets for that? Or?
Well, out-of-pockets is an interesting issue. One of our guests today is Associate Professor Louisa Gordon from QMIR Birkhoff, who's a health economist. And Louisa and I have done quite a bit of work in out-of-pockets for cancer patients. Do you want to talk about the scale of out-of-pockets for patients and cancer patients in particular, Louisa, what we're talking about here?
Yeah, sure. So there's this term in the cancer field called financial toxicity, and what this just means is it's a source of pain, like an adverse event from cancer, same as nausea or vomiting or something like that, and it's actually referring to the financial stress of having cancer because of very high out-of-pocket expenses.
This is
people treated in the private system for cancer?
Yes, but we've done studies with private and public. So you're right, public patients are mostly covered for their expenses. They still have other types of expenses if they go to allied health professionals in private practice, when they go to their GPs. Sometimes they've got to go back to private practitioners for ongoing care and services. They've got travel expenses, all kinds of expenses that are sort of hidden from the figures that you would see, I think, in your work, because it's more administrative collection of data. But we've done some research where we surveyed 300 men who had prostate cancer. They were from all over Australia. They were from rural and metropolitan areas. And about 70% of these men had private health insurance. And we found that what they were reporting to us was the median out-of-pocket cost was around $8,000. And actually 75% of them were paying something like $17,000. This happens because of quite high charges, fees by doctors, and it's not covered by Medicare and private health insurance. They get a very harsh bill shock. They don't discuss fees with their doctors beforehand, so we're trying to get patients to discuss what their options are. Some of them are so angry because they've been paying health insurance for 25 years and they're just simply not covered, and it's unfair. And I think, you know, they have a right to be angry. I mean, prostate cancer is quite a common disease. It shouldn't really be something that might be odd to pay for. But then you've got doctors that really charge high fees. After we published that work, there was quite a bit of a media storm around it, and the Society of Urologists came out and said, "Oh, the study's not very good, and you know, it's not true, and we all charge reasonable costs." But I think the evidence is there. I mean, these men did actually send in some of the evidence of these fees, so it's not made up. I know women with breast cancer are still facing these high costs. They have to pay for MRIs and PET scans. They have to pay for things that aren't covered by Medicare, and it's causing a lot of stress in the community. And I think it's all about value. You know, people want more value from the health system. I think what surprises me is that we have this universal healthcare system and we've got this private healthcare system that's supposed to complement and supplement the public system, but we've got really high out-of-pocket expenses and we've got some of the highest in the OECD world. So clearly we've got some market failure.
Okay, thanks, Louisa. Elaine, you've got a...
I've got a question from Brent Walker. So, a couple of statements as well. So he's saying we need full transparency on costs and prices for the health insurance system to remain sustainable. Why are the costs and prices of prosthetic appliances so opaque? Why not require anybody taking a commission or contributing to the cost of these to disclose these amounts? Why has APRA significantly reduced the transparency of the system by drastically cutting back on the information disclosed in the statistical information provided to health insurers? This should be reversed.
Okay, so a couple of interesting things there. I'll sort of throw open for... So, first of all, we've got a number of representatives of APRA in the audience, so you might want to comment on, you know, why you've evilly reduced transparency in the system. And then this issue of prostheses, if anybody... That's been a very active area of discussion about private health insurers and, you know, prostheses prices. Anyone want to comment on either of those? Jamie Reid.
So I just wanted to talk about the survey a little bit, if we could. I mean, that seems like a really important piece of work to collect this comprehensively. I guess, you know, insurers could produce a product that did cover all out-of-pocket costs. You know, perhaps we need a bit of tinkering with the regulations to do it, but no reason why that product couldn't exist overseas. The challenge is in Australia, it would be so expensive that no one would buy it. And I suppose this goes to system sustainability issues that ultimately the premium will follow the costs. So if we put all these things into PHI, the cost goes up.
I think the bigger problem is, Jamie, if you tell someone that if I'm covering 100% of your costs, you're writing a blank check to the specialist to charge what he likes, because the specialist has refused to enter into a contract with the health insurer to give the health insurer certainty over what the cost will be.
I guess that was what I was going to come into. So you know, it's not about the premium or the scope of product, it's about the cost of the services. Now we can talk about how we're going to tinker with our system or community rating or risk equalisation or whatever, but ultimately the cost of the services goes back to the customers. So it needs to all be about how we contract for the cost of those services, and obviously because we're just 8% of the market, it has to be about how the Australian government contracts for services.
What seems to be lacking, though, I guess from just a normal consumer, is the lack of conversation with the customer. So the customer just doesn't get it. So I guess we understand all of those issues, but I guess the question is, it reminds me of things like even like flood insurance, people don't realise they're not covered. And obviously, it reminds me of superannuation. People aren't engaged in the retirement debate. So how can we get them engaged so they actually understand, or are we saying, most of the time you're actually only going to be covered for 70% of the costs? So what about, how good do you think the PHI are engaging their customers about the level of benefit, or are customers just not interested?
Look, I guess it is an often sort of ponder on this, that there's lots of things we buy that we research to death. Buying making quite small investments where we research all the options and the ins and outs, whereas quite major decisions in our lives, we we're happy just to take Medibank because they've got the nicest logo or what have you, or they're the cheapest. So I mean, it's a question for smarter people than me. How do we move our product from the bucket of things that people like to think about and engage with, where it is now.
But if I may, I think a range of issues for consumers, and I obviously, my organisation's, one of its things is to represent consumers that they just don't understand. So, for example, a man with prostate cancer faces a choice between surgery and radiotherapy. Surgery would obviously be a in-hospital procedure, and therefore will be covered by private health insurance. Radiotherapy, which is an equally valid treatment modality, is always not as an inpatient service, so would not be covered. But does that really make sense from a consumer's point of view, that you've got a choice between two? In fact, we spend a lot of time as an organisation, because we work both with the surgeons and radiation oncologists, trying to explain to men that you've got those two options. Does that make sense? And then the one that always cracks me up, so you go and you have an operation, but you have to pay for the anaesthetist. Like, why is that? I just think we have to acknowledge, as, professionals in insurance and health insurance, if you like, that from a consumer's point of view, it doesn't make any sense at all. And it's called private health insurance. And I think, I can't speak for every consumer in Australia, but I think people think that if you pay your insurance premiums, you're covered. I said to a couple of people earlier, if you took out contents insurance on your house and you discovered that it doesn't cover the roof, but it covers other parts of the building, you'd just be going, what's this nonsense? Like, it's an important issue, and maybe we should move on to it, I think.
Couple what you said back to one of your original statements?
Can we ask you to speak up? Apparently the people in Melbourne are finding it hard to hear. Thanks.
Okay, Stuart Roger from Deloitte again. Just want to couple what you said back to one of your original statements about the 18% out-of-pocket, 8% health insurance premium. We pay 25% of our health costs out of our own pocket, be it through individual payments or our net health insurance premium. At a systemic kind of level, that's probably not a bad level for out-of-pockets. There's a stake in the game, but most of it is spread by community government of some kind or another. Within that 25%, 8%, as you said, but in fact it's more like 11% because of the government rebate, is spread through the private health insurance system. And for all its defects that are creeping in with exclusions and so on, that is at least a smoothing process where the most catastrophic claims can be covered, and the weakness is that an ill-informed consumer may choose to exclude it from his cover to get a cheaper premium, but that's the weakness. But the kind of thing we've just been hearing about with cancer and the out-of-pocket costs that can arise, that brings into question the 18% that is nothing to do with health insurance. Some of that is relatively trivial. It's the out-of-pockets you pay to buy drugs where the PBS has subsidised most of it. So you can carve away at that 18% and end up with probably a single-digit figure, which is Australian out-of-pocket expenses, which arise from this complete bill shock kind of stuff. And I know the breast cancer one from our family's experience as well, that the MRI is a massive shock. So it suggests that if you want to talk about it's private health insurance, how come catastrophic costs aren't covered? Yes, there's one thing about insurers telling the consumers what they've really bought and what it would cost to buy what they really want. But there is another one about there's a section of out-of-pocket costs which are truly catastrophic, which are not insured through Medicare. They're not allowed to be insured through private health insurance. And identifying that sector and somehow creating an insurance market around that sector wouldn't have to be compulsory, but it wouldn't even have to be community rated. It could be risk rated. At the moment, there's nothing, and anything would be better than nothing. How do you get there? You look at that 25% out-of-pocket, carve out the health insurance, look at the 18%, carve out the regular chemist and those kind of things, look at what's left, satisfy yourself that actually this is a serious problem for ordinary families, and then set about creating an insurance market around that.
Okay, anyone else?
Yeah, David Torrance, DBN Actuaries. I'd just like to bring it back to a sort of a higher level, if I can. At the end of the day, each of us pays for our health. The question is how much we socialise that, and whether we socialise it through taxes, through the Medicare system, or through some form of, you know, community-rated private health insurance. We've never actually, as a society, had a debate around how much medicine we want to socialise, or how much health costs we want to socialise, and how much we actually want to spend on it. 10% of GDP, you know, if as a community we want to spend 14% of GDP on health, but we want to give up some submarines, that's a perfectly legitimate place to be. So nobody's ever actually had a debate around is 10 good or bad. We just benchmark ourselves off OECD, and again, I don't think they necessarily have that debate. So I think the first thing we need to do is Stuart's point is, you know, we talk about sustainability. Well, I have no idea what sustainability means. What is sustainable? But we haven't had a discussion around. Does sustainability mean 35 insurers and 40% of the population insured? I don't know. So I think the first thing we need to do is just determine how much do we want to spend on health. Then how do we actually spend that? Because, again, we've got a Medicare system that most people think is free. We've got two generations of people that have grown up with it. You've seen when Tony Abbott tried to bring a co-payment in on GPs, you know, the absolute furor that went on around that. So again, how much of this do we pay into the public system? You know, the Commonwealth's grants to the states are going up 6 or 7% per year, but nobody jumps up around and says that's outrageous when private health insurance is going up at, you know, the same sorts of rates. So if you wanted to have a community-rated system, for example, and then have a risk-rated system on top of that, you could almost argue that you've got a Medicare system that's community-rated, and private health insurance should just be a risk-rated system with no risk equalisation, no rebates, and if you want it, you get a whole lot of extra benefits. Again, you come back and you need to define what's going to be covered under the various systems, to your point. But just to throw another thing in the mix as well, is the current private health insurance system basically the young and healthy subsidise the old and the sick. But if you look across society, you know, we're whinging as a society that young people can't actually afford to buy a house now. You've got older people on, you know, great pensions that don't pay any tax. So why should a 30-year-old who can't afford to buy a house be subsidising someone who's 65 with a great pension base, a great house that's worth $3 million in a suburb of Sydney, for their health insurance? To me, that, you know, we need to broaden this question around, you know, what does private health insurance actually cover? Where does it sit? How much do we want to spend on it? Before we actually start then thinking about, you know, well, how do we actually model this private health insurance system? I think there's a much bigger sphere that we need to look at and work out where it actually fits into that. Because I think, to some extent, you're right, that the current system, you can't keep putting your prices up at 8% per year if people's wages aren't going up. There's going to be some impact, unless, of course, you just keep whacking the Medicare levy surcharge up, of course. I think we really need to have a much wider and broader debate about, the health system that we need to have in this country before we start tinkering around with PHI.
So, Elaine, the key question for you is, within the Institute's scope of control, is what David has just said, something that the Institute should embark on, a very difficult, politically mired question, or is something that is within our scope of control, addressing the current private hospital system, and Anthony, that should be its name. It shouldn't be private health insurance. Wrong name.
Yeah.
Started with the wrong name right from the start. Whether the current private hospital system is sustainable. And by sustainable, what I mean there is that we don't get into David the 90s situation that we all lived through, where participation, spirals downwards and premiums spiral upwards. That's not sustainable. And that's the risk now. So, Elaine, mine, that's the key question that you face as the Institute.
Well, look, I guess the way I see it is, within the Institute, we want to do two things. One is obviously help in the commercial world, and a lot of you work in private health insurance and help that better. But then the other angle is obviously the public policy. And for me, that's about helping Australian society better understand the issues it's facing in the long term. Obviously, we can't always have an agreement between the membership. And what we try and do is we try and find agreement. We try and be as bold as possible, but we can't always be. So then in those circumstances, what we try and do is bring our expertise out there and go, here's how we see the issues are landing. And as I think you clearly said and rightly said, community needs to start having these conversations. It's not for us to have the moral judgment of whether it should be 10 or 14%, but we can clearly say these conversations aren't happening. There are naturally trade-offs. These are the kinds of trade-offs. These are the pluses and minuses. So I think that's where we can, as individual actuaries, bring our great expertise. And that's where I think we as the Institute want to try and get more vocal and get more of our experts out there talking about it. Because I think we can help. We can help the debate.
And Elaine, in the era of alternate facts misinformation on, deliberate misinformation on a number of, public policy issues, surely we can bring our evidence-based, fact-based, numerical skills to bear to illuminate the reality of it, the truth of the situation.
Yeah.
So, it's a good contribution. Does anyone want to pick up on how about moving to a fully risk-rated private health insurance system, or still interested in whether APRA would like to comment on reporting and transparency, or this issue of consumer understanding of products? Because I certainly don't think consumers do understand what is and isn't covered.
I was just going to, sorry, Warwick again, and go back to your first question, Anthony, about the role of PHI, because I think in the Australian government, and I've seen it in work we're doing overseas in both Hong Kong and Qatar, they don't define it from a consumer point of view. They don't define the role of PHI from a consumer point of view. I would say that governments look at it as a mechanism for either funding or encouraging investment and funding in private sector involvement in delivering tertiary health services. And I think that's what they see it as. And going into this question about risk rating versus non-risk rating, if you look in Hong Kong at the moment, they have a risk-rated health insurance system. The government there sees the problem as being they have 95% of their services, health services, delivered through the public system. The public system can't cope. The government is in a position where they feel that they can't be producing more hospital beds, more public services. And so they're desperately trying to find ways to encourage the private sector involvement in the health system in Hong Kong. But when you have a private health insurance system that's fully risk rated, the people that purchase it are the young, healthy, fit people that don't need it. So they're not, they buy the private health insurance, but they're not diverting services from the public system to the private system because they're not having services at all. And the people that are using it, the old or the infirm, can't afford risk-rated health insurance, and so they don't buy it, and so they stick to the public system. And the government of Hong Kong looks in from into Australia and says, you have nearly 50% of the population covered by private health insurance. You have a fairly active private hospital system. We want more of that. We want to be able to have what you have. And so, you know, we were talking about this before. I'm not sure that having a fully risk-rated system is something that I think would be the answer either. Could there be a hybrid system that works? I don't know, perhaps. Definitely there are people that are suggesting that some form of rating around behaviours might lead to more healthy behaviour. That's possible. But certainly, I don't think we should immediately jump to think risk rating would solve our problems, because I don't think it will. I come back to the point that Jamie was making, and the point of the survey is that you can only have an insurance product where you can control the cost inputs, where that you have an ability through the structure of your product to control the costs. If you've got a system where some of the participating providers basically have carte blanche around what they could charge, you either have an insurance policy that can't cover it all, and hence you're going to have out-of-pockets, or you're going to have an insurance policy that will forever be at risk of increasing at an astronomical rate. 7 or 8% will seem like the good old days under that sort of situation. So I don't know, but I go back to, and I think it's the same point David's making, the underlying problem is not how we fund these services. It's how the actual delivery mechanism works and where the control points or the lever points in that delivery mechanism are. And I guess my view is, until there's really solid data being collected and put out into the public arena and to the people that make the decisions, you're never going to see real movement, because it's, as you're saying, misinformation. People will use the anecdote rather than the actual facts.
Similar points to Warwick on the risk rating. Be careful of what you wish for. Look at a few models around the world. So the UK model, which came to mind with what you were saying, Dave, where we've got a public health system and then any health insurance on top of that's risk rated. Well, that's the UK model, and a very small section is risk rated. Everyone, extremely wealthy people, expect their national health entitlements. Another model, the US model, where employers have carried the load and there's massive government payment for people in retirement. And guess what? They're moving away from risk rating towards no underwriting, toward limits on the premium. So the move there is towards community rating, not away from it. I'm also familiar with Singapore, which is interesting, because in Singapore, you pay for your hospital visits. Everyone now has a basic level of insurance, for which the premiums are risk rated all the way through up to old age and appropriately risk rated. So how does that work? Well, they have this MediSave sitting alongside it. And MediSave is a fund for health costs, which one of the purposes is to allow you to pay your out-of-pocket hospital costs. Another one is to allow you to pay for your insurance premiums, both your MediShield national health insurance premiums and your private health insurance premiums. So the one thing about MediSave is that the contributions that go into that are 7% of income each year. right? So, and to put that in context, the contributions that go into your central provident fund for retirement and house purchase are about 28%, right? So the money that you contribute towards, or that is contributed on your behalf towards your health costs, is a quarter of your entire superannuation and housing costs, 7% against 28%. And they still have problems with the Medisave because how generations cross each other in the family. But it does allow a risk-rated insurance system to be operable by just about everybody in the population, with obvious exceptions in the kind of bottom 10%, which have other sources of support. So three different models for risk rating. The only one that I think works is the one where, back to Richard Madden's point, they have set up reserves. They call it a health savings account, but it is still pre-funding of predictable later deferred health costs. The other two systems are not ones where either the US one being sustainable, not really, or the UK one not really calling on private health insurance. It's a trivial element.
Yes, I'd just like to make a couple of points, I guess, on the risk rating. I can see, obviously, why it wouldn't work, but I guess it does raise two issues. One, certainly, the intergenerational issue, which you made. I think that's a really important point, and that's where it does start breaking down if word gets out, I guess, or else how you perceive it. Is it a lifetime premium, or is it, a current premium?
The lack of reserving, that's the issue lack that was pointed first.
Yeah,
up.
We obviously, I suppose, we missed
a decade and a half of equitable cross-generation funding by not building those reserves.
And I think we looked at that issue, who will fund our health, through the white paper or the green paper. And I guess the general view was there isn't enough money around. We can barely kind of pre-fund the superannuation and some of those other issues. So it's interesting, will there really be that money to pre-fund? But the other issue I wanted to bring up was, I guess, the whole disruption fintech data analytics space around where's our ability to encourage good behaviour? And is there any feedback loops, and how can you bring that into a community-rated system?
Because having a good, healthy life isn't enough of an incentive.
No, it isn't.
Yeah, no. Saving a few bucks on your health insurance premium is,
it's a serious point. Not getting killed in a car accident because you're drunk or not drunk is exactly the same thing. And an important part of the answer to your question lies in the cultural engineering that we undertook through the late 70s, 80s and 90s to make drink driving something that you just don't do.
So, with driving, it's exactly the same. We've got CTP, a community-rated product, and as a result, telematics doesn't have the same incentive to get off the ground in Australia, where we can give that feedback loop to people of, actually, you're not a great driver, you should slow down, you shouldn't brake so fast, you shouldn't whatever. We can't. There isn't the same incentive to get that technology introduced. And I guess it possibly is the same in the health space.
But we did engineer people out of drink driving as a way of life.
Yeah, no, sure.
Cultural, social engineering, not insurance structures.
So, okay, Justin from Quantium, just to answer your question. We do, we're part-owned, our health subsidiary, by Discovery Health, South African insurer. They have this vitality program. And there they do give premium reductions for good behaviour, collect a lot of data as a result. I think they've given out basically Apple Watches to all of their members who've signed up and maintained on the program. So there are ways around the direct premium reduction. And I think in Australia we'll see how well, say, the Qantas loyalty program does, which again is not necessarily through the premium, but through the bells and whistles on the side. But picking up on that, I think
one could argue is contrary to the community rating legislation, but
But if they get away with it,
that's another debate that we could have. I'm surprised none of the other health insurers have actually taken them on. But anyway,
there's good behaviour from members, and I think there's also good behaviour from doctors. And if you come back to the question on what's the percentage GDP we're willing to spend, I would say, show me what you get for your 18% in the US. Now they don't live twice as long as us, but I'd be happy to spend 20%. And this is the whole system, not PHI. If we could live for twice as long, I wouldn't be happy to do that if Ramsey got a 5x earnings boost. Right? And I think there is a role, just back to how do we reward doctors for good behaviour. There's a missing piece of data. If we only measure the activity And because we pay for it, then we will drive activity, and that's what we're seeing in the utilization. If we measure what actually happens to our patients and to our members, and are they getting better, then we have recourse to say, well, why are you doing so many colonoscopies? Is that really necessary? Are our patients getting better? And I think without that data, it's quite hard to control costs, and we'll always get back to the, well, the doctor says it's okay, and I can't argue with them. So that's one thing we're advocating very strongly for.
Jack Fitzpatrick from, I don't work in health insurance anymore, but I guess with all those sort of extras, health incentives on the health insurance, the churn in the industry has sort of gone up and up and up and up. And a lot of these incentives are paying off on a very long-term scale. So that, is there really that incentive for insurers to be spending on health improvement if in 5-10 years there's sort of only a 1 in 4 chance they're still going to be with you, and someone else is sort of wearing that sort of benefit from the improved health, especially if it's not until 20-30 years down the track that they actually see that health improvement pay off in sort of reduced hospitalizations?
One side effect from these engagement programs, or these vitality programs, is that they improve your engagement with your members. So they're much more likely to actually stay with you. And I think that's where part of the benefit comes, not just to reduce utilization, but reduce churn.
Jamie Reid again. I guess one thing I struggle with, so every one of these ideas on its own has merit. So avoiding healthier lifestyles would be one, tinkering with pricing the system, maybe there's waste around prosthesis and so on. So they're all good ideas on their own. I guess what I struggle with is, which of these are actually going to make any difference? Obviously, if there's waste, if there's a good idea, you should take it. But I guess I have a suspicion that even if you took all these good ideas, and that you're never going to get premium increases anywhere near wages. It'd be interesting maybe to say of all the ideas that are thrown up in health every day, there's one in the paper every day, where's the important things? Where's the things we should be focusing on? And even if we do get it right, where is the total cost going to go, and can we wear them?
Yeah, Simon Lim from Ernst & Young. I think the biggest obstacle to financial-based incentives for good behavior, meaning premium reductions, is, well, then that shortfall in premiums will have to be made up somewhere, which would actually drive the premium, the other premiums. It will drive higher inflation in the other premiums. Because if you have an average premium, right, and people who are having good behavior, they're all having lower risk, would have claims cost less than average premiums, so you give them a discount. But then now all of a sudden the premium pool has reduced, and so then you're still needing to meet all the other claims costs of the unhealthy people, and so where would that come from? And so that would actually drive up the premiums even more. And I think my second point is the question on whether or not there should be full risk rating or partial risk or the degree of risk rating. I think that's more of a moral question, because in any system, there's going to be winners and losers. In the current system, you have the healthier people subsidizing the unhealthy people, and that sort of tends to be correlated with the age. In a risk-rated system, it would be the other way around, where people who are claiming a lot and are unhealthy won't be able to afford it, so there'll be losers in that. And so the decision point becomes, well, which group's needs are more important than the trade-off between that? So it's not so much a technical question.
As far as risk rating goes, I think there's also the political aspect to consider. Like the current political environment, I think you'd probably have more success trying to get health insurance abolished entirely than having it fully risk rated. So you might want to try and you could probably argue for some aspects of risk rating, things like smoking, but even then I'm not sure the data actually shows that smokers cost health insurers more based on what I've read.
Okay, we've got about half an hour left, so I'd encourage contributions from people who haven't spoken.
And from Melbourne.
And from Melbourne, yes. We've had one contribution from Melbourne, so it would be good to have some more. So anybody who hasn't spoken like to make a contribution?
The menu from Kermore Travel Insurance.
Can you maybe just move this one?
So I work in a travel insurance company. So I'm not very familiar with the Australian health insurance, but what amazed me is when we look at medical claims in the US, the amount that they charge and the amount we can actually pay is like 30-40% different. So we engage a cost containment company. They look at the items that the US health provider provide, and then they look at the normal cost for these items, and they hold them accountable, and they go and negotiate the true cost with them. And quite often you get a significant discount. So I'm just wondering, is there any organization or any company doing that kind of thing in Australia? So to hold the health provider accountable for the cost they charge.
Any responses to that question? To health insurers, health providers? Like to comment? Okay, I'm gonna do something that just a little bit unusual. So we've got a couple of representatives of the Institute's PR agency in the audience. So I think it would be interesting to hear so we're looking at this from inside the industry, right, which is what we do. But one of the things we wanted to do with this colloquy today is actually make sure we have people from outside the Institute from who maybe don't understand why premium rises have to, premium rates have to rise like that. So could we have a contribution on what does this look like, you know, if you're a reader of The Australian or you watch Sky News or what's going on in the media world? What do the media guys think about all of this?
Ian Pemberton's my name, P&L Corporate. We did a white paper on health a few years ago, which got good play. But it is a very select audience in the media. That means that it goes to an A-list readership, Financial Review of The Australian. I think PHI in particular is extremely complicated, and it's probably a turn-off for most readers, especially nowadays when you're reading online rather than print. You're looking at the top three or four sentences in a story and then moving on to something else. So for the actuaries to position itself on a very important public policy topic, but it's also a complicated one, it needs to have very defined objectives and targets and messaging. And I think today the standout for me is the research from the prostate group on sticker shock, price shock, the charges of medical specialists, providers, people identify with those issues. But it is a sensitive and political area, so there's caution needed as far as making recommendations, especially if the membership's not united. The idea of or agree, the idea of the Institute is to propose ideas for follow-up with policymakers in Canberra in particular. So it will get good play, any paper you consider putting out, but you need to target it very exactly with the right journalists. And there's very few health writers these days in the mainstream press. Those who are writing about health are usually writing about other topics as well, so you've got to capture their attention and you've got to really sell it hard into them that this is something that's going to interest their readers.
I'll just point out, myself here, but The Guardian has actually run quite an extensive series on the value provided to consumers of private health insurance and some, got some consumer feedback as well.
The consumer focus is extremely sellable. It's a good focus for any green paper that the actuaries would put out. So again, it's a targeted set of messaging that you need to agree on. The further you go into health policy, though, the more complicated it can be. So you've just got to be aware that all the big ideas mightn't get coverage in the press. Just the top level three main public policy positions are the ones that will sell.
That Guardian series highlights some of the problems of press too. I can think of at least a couple of articles which were totally based around the usual suspects, anti-health insurance, and to an outsider, wow, they're professors and, you know, they must be authoritative and cover the whole ground. But to an insider, you knew what they would say before they said it. And The Guardian, the two that I remember reading out of that series, both fell into that trap. But there were more, presumably.
And that's one of the reasons to why we're holding this colloquy. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I guess just, first of all, I'll remind people why the Actuaries Institute does public policy. So I guess there's kind of a few reasons. One is for the public benefit. We believe we've got expertise that we should be adding to these really difficult issues society is facing. Secondly, to show our expertise, because ultimately showing our expertise improves our brand, gets people jobs. You know, governments will ask actuaries, hey, can you be involved in helping me solve this problem? So that's good. And third, because it creates a good sense of community. Actuaries, the feedback is members actually find it a good thing that the Institute and actuaries are speaking up on these important topics. So that's, first of all, I guess, why we do it. One of the reasons why we've had this colloquy, I guess, especially, is because, you know, these issues are in the newspapers. Susan Lay is asking, you know, what is the value proposition? And loads of you guys have opinions. And what we want to do in some ways is to work out, well, where can we answer? Some of it can be behind the scenes, some of it can be in front. But again, it's this idea of bringing our expertise to help simplify some of these really complicated issues. And that's always our challenge as actuaries, simplifying complicated issues. Where we want to take this, I guess, is for the Health Practice Committee and the Public Policy Council Committee to kind of think about the great issues that have been brought up, think about what we can do with them. There's different forums that are happening anyway. So there's the Health Insurance Conference. There's papers being written for the Actuaries Summit. One of the things that the Public Policy Council Committee want to do is we've done these great big white papers, green papers. We want to actually do more now, four-page thought leadership pieces, which are kind of, here are serious issues coming up that society needs to deal with. Here's how it could be viewed. So try and get some smaller pieces that get out quicker. And we think a lot of these topics potentially could be dealt with in that. The advantage of them is that then it becomes an Actuaries Institute piece. We can use them as op-ed in newspapers. We can use them in digital. And it kind of also improves the brand of individual actuaries. So we're really kind of broadly thinking, look, you know, it's great to just see all the amazing big picture ideas and then try and actually, you know, you never know, you might get a phone call from me going, hey, but trying to work out what can be best. So anybody who has ideas, please let us know.
Public policy is really good for increasing the brand of the actuary, but at the same time, you know, we work for the industry and we have to reflect their views, so we can't just go out and say something that would be, you know, not in their interests. And this has happened before, so, you know, this is a conflict that is not easily resolved. We can't just go out and say whatever you want to say without considering our other stakeholders.
Yeah, look, it's always a difficult issue. Certainly when we do submissions from public policy's perspective, we're supposed to take our corporate hat off. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if we think that there's something that, you know, that isn't in the benefit of Australian society, but that's in the benefit of a certain private health insurer, we've got to be careful because in the long run, that sequel will probably get out. But having said that, we need to be very tactful about how we deal with these issues. So in other words, I guess, ultimately, we should all be on the same plate. You know, even private health insurers want what's best for the system, you know. But, and that wouldn't be saying like, you know, okay, we should ban private health insurers. So, you know, I agree that could be a position. But what we can only do is basically put forward what we believe it represents the majority of members. So we're very careful about that. Well, and we'll try and be increasingly, because I know we did have issues with our last submission. So that's also one of the reasons to get people in the room so we know who has views. So if we put forward positions in future, we can consult, you know, and go, okay, do you agree? Do you not? Can we tone this down? What should we do? We want to be more consultative with this group.
We should just correct one thing on the record you said, Ben. Our stakeholders are not the industry. As a profession, our stakeholders include individual consumers, people who are retired, working through superannuation funds, governments, ACOS and its organisations use actuaries as well. And so I just don't want on the record for our stakeholders of the industry to stay unchallenged.
Yeah, no, you're right. We're definitely not an industry group, and our submissions are for the public benefit, and that will be in companies who would do their own. So actuaries would often write submissions on behalf of their own companies or industry groups, but we've got to take a broader perspective of stakeholders.
And we do have more freedom than the insurers, because, I mean, there's people out there knocking the insurance industry every day. Maybe it makes the industry a little bit reluctant to talk about large out-of-pocket costs, for example, which, you know, are sort of knocking the product somewhere. I wonder if that comes up so much, if you know, maybe a position we could take, a small fourth piece, would be around, can we do something on this catastrophe cover? We're not going to cover bottomless, outrageous medical fees. But, you know, maybe we say, look, if someone does have one of these most serious injuries, maybe we can start paying for, you know, some of the out-of-hospital consultations. Maybe we can push for that rule change. Maybe we could pay for scans to a greater extent. So just take some of the bill shock away without, you know, making it like cheaper. That would be a step forward if we go from this 8% share of PHI that we're actually, you know, taking on some more of the service. We're adding some value and growing our sector.
Doesn't that product already exist in the life insurance industry? Isn't there a product where if you get a certain disease, you get a lump sum? Look, I'm not that kind of thing to cover that risk.
Yeah, so the critical illness, yeah. Maybe that's the product. But it, I guess a lot of people with health insurance fees have already bought it. So yeah, maybe we build some of that in, and that would grow our sector and address a customer.
So I've got a couple of comments from Melbourne, so let's get these out. So Andrew Gale, a comment on private health insurance price increases. Price increases for private health insurance should be viewed in the wider context of overall consumer price increases being around 1.5%, which covers the basket of goods that consumers spend their money on, including private health insurance premiums. Above average cost increases in health are being offset by low price increases or decreases in other consumer costs. So that's his point. Cathy Ryan says, affordability could be driven by greater competition amongst private health insurers. For example, legislation prevents insurers from funding alternative outpatient services and limits discounting. Do insurers lose benefits of scale and competition with 36 private health insurers in the Australian market because of these factors? Consumer confusion is added to by these factors, with some small insurers now seeking significant premium increases.
Okay, thanks, Elaine. Still looking to hear from, we've got about 15 minutes to go till 2 o'clock. I think we'd all be very happy to be out here on time or a little bit early. That's certainly the intention, but I'd like to hear from anybody who's got either an issue that we haven't talked about that we should have talked about, or anybody who hasn't yet spoken. So maybe we'd go round the circle. And if you wish to say something, then speak now.
And I guess just adding to that, whether you think there's anything that the Actuaries Institute should specifically be dealing with, kind of like Jamie said, is there a certain issue you think we could tackle?
Yes, good point. So maybe I sort of, you know. Anybody?
Something you have not covered,
yes.
From your list of questions, is what is the perceived value of having health insurance in Australia? Now, of course, I would reframe that, hospital insurance, and I'll bet those Guardian articles didn't refer to the claims that are paid by, you know, private health hospital insurance, so didn't highlight that. Hospital insurers are starting to send to older patients the costs of their claims. And if you talk to older Australians, many of them will say, we don't care what the price of private hospital insurance goes up by, we get $20,000 a year back on this, and that's why we have this product. So going to value, I think this is a really very important question. Clearly it is doctor of your choice, in-hospital doctor of your choice, and also avoidance of waiting lists that are an essential part of any Medicare type system. And those values need to be reinforced, maybe even costed and communicated, increasingly with a very poor quality in-hospital public system. A young person, in my opinion, would need to think pretty carefully before they give up their private hospital insurance.
Anecdotally, Rob, I don't know whether this is right, maybe some health insurers can comment, but I hear a lot of commentary about people saying that young people are dropping out and old people are then opting back in because they can see the value that you're talking about. So notwithstanding the way the system works, if you come back into the system at an older age, they're actually kind of gaming the system in that way. Can anyone comment on that, whether that there are
the data supports that participation in the 60s is now up 60% plus. And of course, this is the group that has the superannuation assets. The group that's 80 plus doesn't have the superannuation assets because the system wasn't open for them. But the people in the 60s and 70s have the superannuation assets, and the industry can expect to see, in my opinion, materially increased participation from older Australians above 60. 60 being the average age for hospital claims. Claim-weighted average age is in early 60s currently, and increasing.
Okay, still looking for anybody who hasn't spoken, so I'm just sort of come around here.
I have spoken, but I figured I wanted to... There's something you mentioned at the start that I wanted to bring up again. I think you mentioned Bill Shorten's comments on junk policies.
Yes.
Yeah, I think those sort of low-end hospital products that are just growing more and more and more, and they're being used to sort of fund the risk equalization pool, but they're giving absolutely nothing to the consumer just about. And they're supported by those Medicare levy surcharge and other regulations. I can't imagine that's going to last forever. I mean, it's a fairly inefficient way of subsidizing that system. And at some point, surely the government's going to see, rather than forcing people to pay into this money, into the health insurance, we can just take that as tax and spend that on what we want to do instead of having the health insurers take that, have a profit margin and subsidize their own health insurance. I just wonder how well prepared the industry is for that sort of possibility. I think I've even seen some articles lately floating that.
Look, I just, for what it's worth, in terms of the engagement that we have with politicians, my guess would be that they'll introduce something to restrict the exclusions. In other words, further regulation is what I would guess. But others might have a different view.
That would probably be a good thing, I think. I think it's kind of...
Well, it depends on what your objective is. You take those people out of the system and the cost for everyone else will go up. So if that's an okay outcome, well, then fine, you do that. I take issue at one of the things you said, that it's being used to fund health insurers' profits. Like, the health insurance industry has the greatest payout of premium than any other insurance industry anywhere, probably. You know, 92 cents in the dollar about goes back in claims. So in terms of value, you can't really see any more value than you get in the current system.
But do you think that's,
you know, the money they collect is only being used to pay someone else's claims. If you take that away, what you end up with is everyone else paying a bit more. Now, that might be fine. You might say that's the desired outcome. But every person that you pull out that's costing you less than average is meaning that someone else is going to pay more.
But I guess externally it's not going to be, and certainly by the government, I don't think it would be necessarily seen like that. And I know with a lot of those low-end hospital products, the price that's been, at least from when I've looked at it, the price being charged isn't actually that much more than what's going into the risk equalization pool for those products.
That's right.
So they're probably actually
so it's quite
losing
efficient.
Money on that end of the product, but then getting it back on the other end.
That would be fine if the government took the tax that it's earning on those people and put it into the risk equalization pool, for example. So you're still getting the same amount of money coming back into the system, but they probably
won't. Because
the cost of the risk equalization pool will still be there with or without those people. Or the only difference is whether or not you're getting their premiums or not.
The irony of the system at the moment is that because of the risk equalization, so people on your, I don't like the term that they call it, your junk policy, their price is actually driven by the experience of people over the age of 55 or 65. So it's sort of an inverse thing that the people on the cheaper policies are getting the higher costs and higher premium increases, and the people on the higher cost policies and older who are subsidised actually theoretically are getting lower premium rate increases. So again, you just got this sort of vicious circle.
But it's the natural consequence of the system that
the system
was designed.
Right.
Like, you know, you cannot think of any more optimal result than what's happened based on the rules that we've got. So, you know, to complain about junk policies is to complain about the fact that
the system we, the government, designed was faulty in our eyes now. So you have...
But effectively, that's what the government's doing, looking at the system and going, should we rewrite the rules?
Mm. Well, that's kind of... without defining their objectives.
Oh,
and,
totally.
I think we all suffer for this across the whole of the health sector, is that understanding what are the objectives in the first place would give us a great leg up to saying, okay, well, now we understand what you're trying to achieve, we can design a system to achieve that.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's responding to random faults that are being observed.
Sure. And certainly when the Actuaries Institute responds to submissions, different things, we often try starting with the principles because it just makes it easier for us to answer. Just following on, I've got Anthony Claughton from KPMG. On catastrophe cover and life insurance, would most people expect they're covered beforehand already? Is there any way with technology that the industry can try and bring the information into the policyholders' hands far earlier, even before surgery, to make the experience more like a general insurance claim where you know the various costs of fixing the car before you go out and do it?
Okay, now we're starting, people are obviously starting to think they've got to get back to work, so I'm just going to have one last call for comments from anyone. Yes?
Look, I think if the Institute is looking at public policy and any kind of health review, you start right at the top, which is the aggregation of all the different funding mechanisms, not just private health insurance, but also the government paid and out-of-pocket. Look at the health system as a whole, and then to David's point about, well, are we paying too much, and are we getting the right quality that we're getting? And then from there, all the discussions are about how the rules around private health or primary health or all the other funding mechanisms, they're basically just changing the mix and the incentives and behaviours of the whole system.
Okay, thanks very much. One last comment, and then we'll wrap up.
One for Elaine, just in terms of old people, affordability of health in Australia generally. Ignatius and I did some work a few years ago on how people will afford out-of-pocket costs in their old age, and we compared the growth of the superannuation system with the growth of health costs that were being paid out of people's pockets, and you could see that the situation was getting better. And then the Institute has also done work, and ASFA has, on what are the needs of people in retirement from their super fund. And so the Institute could inject a lot more analysis and insight into the health components of that retirement income requirement. And then that would lead actually to policy options that are worth discussing about the intergenerational equity, and do we have to have it the way it currently is?
Okay, thanks everybody. I'd like to thank everyone in Melbourne. I hope that you can hear, we're able to hear. Thank everybody else. Thank you very much. Some great contributions. I know you'll be taking them forward, Elaine. And I've got to just conclude with some commentary by President Trump. Nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Yeah. That's good.